Prabhupada ki jai, Nantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai, Namacharya Srila Haridasa Thakur ki jai, Prem Shikho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shri Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana ki jai, Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai, Mathura Dhamma ki jai, Avadvipa Mayapur Dhamma ki jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai, Gangamaya Jamuna Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Maharani ki jai, Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nivasesis and Nivani Paskatyade Satarane. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutaha Padakamalam Shri Guru and Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpati Vishaki Vasandhyavatam Dijanam Bhavanevi Vaishnavanam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. That's one of those super heavy garlands, right? About 5 pounds. So today is June 16th, 2019, in Brooklyn, New York. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 9. If you have a phone, you can find the verse. Text 11. Panduputra Mupasinam.
Panduputra Mupasinam.
Pashraya Prema Sangatan.
Pashraya Prema Sangatan.
Abhyachastanuragashrar
Andibhutena Chakshusha
Pandu. The late father of Maharaj Yudhisthira and his brothers.
The late father of Maharaj Yudhisthira and his brothers.
Putran.
The sons of.
Upasinan.
Sitting silently nearby.
Prashraya.
Being overtaken.
Prema.
In feelings of love.
Sangatan.
Having gathered.
Abhyaschasta.
Congratulated.
Anuraga.
Feelingly.
Ashray.
By tears of ecstasy.
Andibhutena.
Overwhelmed.
Chakshusha.
With his eyes.
Srila Prabhupada's translation and purport. The sons of Maharaj Pandu were sitting silently nearby, overtaken with affection for their dying grandfather. Seeing this, Bhishma Dev congratulated them with feeling. There were tears of ecstasy in his eyes, for he was overwhelmed by love and affection. Text 11. 1911. Purport. When Maharaj Pandu died, his sons were all small children, and naturally they were brought up under the affection of elderly members of the royal family, specifically by Bhishma Dev. Later on, when the Pandavas were grown up, they were cheated by cunning Duryodhana and company, and Bhishma Dev, although he knew that the Pandavas were innocent and were unnecessarily put into trouble, could not take the side of the Pandavas for political reasons. At the last stage of his life, when Bhishma Dev saw his most exalted grandsons, headed by Maharaj Yudhisthira, sitting very gently at his side, the great warrior grandfather could not check his loving tears, which were automatically flowing from his eyes. He remembered the great tribulations suffered by his most pious grandsons. Certainly he was the most satisfied man because of Yudhisthira's being enthroned in place of Duryodhana, and thus he began to congratulate them. Panduputra Nupasinam Pashraya Prema Sangatam Abhyachastanurag Ashrayar Andibhutena Chakshusha. The sons of Maharaj Pandu were sitting silently nearby, overtaken with affection for their dying grandfather. Seeing this, Bhishma Deva congratulated them with feeling. There were tears of ecstasy in his eyes, for he was overwhelmed by love and affection. So here we have the word prema. And the word prema here is being used in relationship to the Pandavas' feeling for Bhishma Deva. So this is quite interesting because in the Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami specifically states that the meaning of the word prema, and he is quoting Bhishma Deva, is that one's love is only for Krishna and not for anybody else. And we have, of course, Kunti giving her prayers to Krishna in relation to the Pandavas, saying that, and her family, the Vrishnis and the Pandavas, saying he wants her affection to flow like the Ganges to the sea without being impeded by anything else, and that she wants to cut off her tie of affection for her family members and only be devoted to Krishna. So how interesting that Kunti is defining the goal of life as having only Krishna as the object of affection, even putting aside her family members, such as the Pandavas. We have Bhishma Dev, who defines prema as being only in love with Krishna and not having any affection for anyone else. And here we have the word prema being used as the kind of feeling the Pandavas have for Bhishma. And we have Bhishma, who is reciprocating, Srila Prabhupada is writing, ecstasy. That Bhishma Dev is feeling ecstasy in seeing the Pandavas, and he's crying. We have, of course, a nice example here, as today they have this term, toxic masculinity, right? People who think that being a man means that you always have to be, you know, like emotionless. But here we see Bhishma, who was, I think, without any doubt, a very, very manly kind of man. And he was definitely not an effeminate man by any calculation. And still he's crying out of love and affection. So that one could be both a very manly and also very affectionate is also indicated here. But we have this particular conundrum that how is it that the Pandavas are feeling prema for Bhishma and Bhishma is feeling affectionate for the Pandavas, although they are all pure devotees of the Lord. They're all experiencing prema for the Lord, who of course is also present here. And yet they're having these feelings for each other. What does this mean? So of course, if we read Srila Prabhupada's purport, this particular purport of Srila Prabhupada is describing the family situation. How there was affection between them because of a family situation. That the Pandavas lost their father at a young age. They were raised by Bhishma Dev in place of their father. So naturally, they had great love for their, he would have been their great uncle, although they often called him grandfather. So they had a great love for this grandfather figure, Bhishma Dev, and that Bhishma had a lot of love for them. So they had natural affection due to a family relationship. And then you might ask the question, well, why was Bhishma trying to kill them? Why were they trying to kill each other? And Prabhupada just says, there was political reasons. So there was political reasons, but actually, Bhishma wanted them to be happy. So in reading this, we might just think, oh, Prabhupada is just describing some ordinary relationships of ordinary people in some sort of family drama. And all of us took birth in a family. All of us have some experience of a family. And I think that all of us know that there's in every family, there's some sort of drama. Yes? Every family has some kind of drama going on. Some families it's very extreme. Some families it's very minor. I read an article some years ago about the modern families, what's happening because of divorce. And you know that there's like almost half a chance of people getting divorced with their first marriage. With the second marriage it goes up to like 60%. The third marriage is like 75%. And so what happens is people are married, they have some children, they get divorced, and then they each marry somebody else who was married before and who had children. So you get these what we call blended families, right? But then those blended families also divorce. So then you get ex-stepchildren and an ex-stepmother and an ex-stepfather and ex-step-grandchildren and ex-step-brothers, right? So you have these people that, you know, some kid who grew up with his stepbrother for maybe 10 or 15 years. They slept in the same room. They grew up together. but then their parents get divorced and marry somebody else again. And so what's their relationship with their ex-stepbrother? And it was saying how the grandparents also often get very close, you know, to the daughter-in-law or the son-in-law, and after their kids divorce, then they don't know what kind of relationship to have with this person. And when that person gets married again, do they go to the wedding? And the grandparents get very close to the stepchildren, and then after that family divorces, what's their relationship with the stepchildren? So modern society has definitely increased the drama in families, you know, by, I'd say, a large power, right? Exponentially increased the drama in families. But there's always been drama in families. There was always, you know, the funny uncle that nobody wanted to talk to, and the, you know, the son who joined the Navy and, you know, came back tattooed and nobody wanted to talk to him. And, you know, all these kind of different things that went on. So we could read this as something like that. Well, this is just some sort of, you know, family intrigue. The father dies, the great uncle raises them, there's this political intrigue with their Yodan, but they're finally meeting at the end and they love each other. You know, like my sister rejected me when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, she didn't talk to me. But then as she was dying, she wanted to see me. So, you know, finally at the end of her life, she says, okay, I'll see my sister, you know. And then I went to see her and we were hugging each other and we were crying. And, you know, okay, there's some ordinary thing like this. But what does this have to do with Krishna consciousness? But it's not an ordinary thing like this. This particular purport cannot be taken in isolation from everything that Prabhupada says in the whole Bhagavatam. And of course, there's some lesson there that people love to take. They use shastra as weapons, right? There's shastra and shastra. Prabhupada quotes the Christian saying, the devil cites shastra, you know, devil cites scripture. So even if you want to prove some demoniac point, you can pull a quote from scripture. And we have an ISKCON now, especially with the Veda base and the internet, where anybody can look up any quote on anything and throw it as a missile at people. So, you know, people can find this particular purport to say it was mundane family intrigue or some other, you know, quote from this and that. But we know from elsewhere that the Pandavas, all the Pandavas, and Bhishma Dev, they're all pure devotees. Bhishma Dev is one of the Mahajanas, right? Swayambhu Narada Sambhu, Komara Kapila Manu. Janaka, what is it? I always get this one. Pralada Janaka Bhishma Balir Vyasa Kir Vayam. So Bhishma is listed as one of the 12 Mahajanas. So what is the question of his being involved in some kind of mundane family affection? And of course we know Arjuna had some bewilderment at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, but then he says, Krishna, my illusion is now gone. So there's no question of Arjuna and Yudhisthira being involved in something mundane. So what is this going on here? And we see that there is love between the devotees. And there is love between the devotees. In fact, Rupa Goswami explains, when he gives the 64 angas of bhakti, he then says that these angas can also be applied to the devotees. So what's the distinction between just some mundane affection, these are my family members, this man raised me, and oh, now the grandnephews that I loved are on the throne and we're reunited and someone's dying. And, you know, what's the difference between that and the love between the devotees? The love between the devotees is not coming from some external bodily connection. External bodily connections are really about how can this, I mean, I'm sorry that I'm going to be a little harsh here, but it's really about, I think I'm this body, and others who are connected with me by bodily relation can give me mental and physical happiness, or can give me mental and physical distress. We see them as our kind of shelter. We see them as our source of happiness. You know, my family members, they're going to take care of me, they're going to love me, they're going to appreciate me, they're going to appreciate me for what I am, they're not going to judge me, they're always going to be there for me, and therefore I love them. Or if they don't do those things, I don't love them. You know, and it really is all about what are people doing for me. And people are thinking, well, I'm going to invest in my family, I'm going to invest in my family, I'm going to invest in my family, because my family's going to do something for me. And after investing in our family, or our friends, or whatever, our society, our country, our occupation, when they don't do something for me, then it's very painful. I invested so much in you, and where are you for me? We used to have a drama that we performed called The Wrong Bank Account. And I must admit, when I was new in ISKCON, I really couldn't understand what it was about. It just kind of confused me. So you may know that you can put money in anybody's account. You all know that? You can't take money out of anyone's account. But if you have their bank name and the bank account number, you can go into that bank and you can deposit any amount of money into anybody's account. So there was a story of this man. He has a job, and every week he got paid, and he would put some of that money into his account in the bank. And when he was ready to retire, he went to the banker and he said, "I want to withdraw my money." And the banker said, "But you don't have any money in your account." He said, "But every week I was putting money into this account." "Well, what was the number?" And he gives the number, and it was somebody else's account. So we are depositing generally our time, our affection, our identity, our money, our energy into accounts of friends and society, friendship and love, as Prabhupada says. Into our country, into our family, into our friends. And we're hoping that if I put my energy and my investment of time into that, that I will get something out. And therefore, we have all this affection. So that's the material side of affection. Prabhupada calls it extended selfishness. But spiritual affection is completely different. Material affection is coming from a feeling of lack and insufficiency. That I feel, you know, well, I can't possibly do everything for myself. You know, if I have to provide my own shelter and my own food and my own clothes and my own medicine and my own meaningful life, how will I be able to do that? So I'm looking for social interaction to fulfill my needs. But on the spiritual level, it's a completely different situation. In 1976, when we were meeting with Prabhupada on 55th Street, so I was sitting with my oldest son on my lap. He was about a year and a half old, and my father was also there. And Prabhupada looked at me and he said, "Just like this mother is loving her son without expectation of return, one should love Krishna." And my father asked Prabhupada, "Will loving her son help her to love Krishna?" Prabhupada said, "No." He said, "But loving Krishna will help her to love her son." So what happens is, when we love Krishna, this is the mystery. When we withdraw our affection from everything and everyone and repose it entirely in Krishna, what happens is we become full to overflowing. Krishna's om purnam adha purnam idam purnat purnat udachate purnasya purnam adaya purnam eva visishate. He's unlimited. And as soon as we are in touch with the unlimited, we are also filled with unlimited love. In the Shikshastika it says, anandam buddhivardhanam. And Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati comments on this by saying that although the jiva is finite, when the jiva is connected with the unlimited Lord, the jiva is able to experience unlimited love and unlimited happiness. So when one is connected with the Lord, when one makes this absolute connection with the Lord to the exclusion of everyone else, one gets filled with unlimited love, which then overflows to everyone else because everyone else is part of God. And therefore we find throughout the Shastra, over and over and over and over and over again, merciful to all living entities, best friend of all living entities, as describing the enlightened soul. That the enlightened soul loves everyone. And genuinely loves everyone. The prema that a pure soul feels for God extends to all living entities, not only to all living entities, to all matter, to everything. As the Isha Upanishad said, never hates anyone nor any being. Not only never hates, but actually has love. I was really meditating upon this yesterday with Srila Prabhupada's physical movements. How we move in this world, how we interact with a chair or a table or anything, our clothing, other living beings, how we move our body, actually is indicative of our mental state. And Srila Prabhupada, you notice that he had this sort of fluid movements with everything. Devotees would describe it that it looked like Srila Prabhupada was floating rather than walking. When devotees gave him a watch that would wind automatically with your movements, it would stop because Prabhupada didn't make unnecessary movements. And devotees would just watch how he would deal with everything. I was really meditating on this yesterday, and I thought, he saw everything as non-different from Krishna, his beloved, his best friend. So he was dealing with everything with affection. This is Krishna's. Just like if we have some article that belongs to someone we love, right? If this belonged to somebody that I love, so I might deal with it with affection. Does that make sense? I would handle it carefully. Just like people keep mementos from some place they had attachment to, some person they had attachment to, and they keep them very carefully. Even if it's just a little piece of cloth or, you know, a plastic ring or something like that. If it's connected with the person they love, they deal with it like a great treasure. So when one loves Krishna, one deals even with objects with great care, with great attachment, as if it was a great treasure. What to speak of with other living entities? Prabhupada dealt with such care with a little bug that would be on his table. You know, he called his servant and he said, "There's a bug that's been on my table for a few hours. I think he's hungry. Can you please take him outside?" But it wasn't just an intellectual, "Oh, there's a bug, I think he's hungry." Prabhupada actually loved the bug. You know, when he went around John Lennon's estate before he left, he was saying, "I was saying goodbye to all the trees." Now, if those who love God feel love and affection for a table and a chair, like Prabhupada said, you're cleaning the floor of the temple, and those who are cleaning the deity is the same. What to speak of the love that the devotees have for other devotees? Why is there such a special love between the devotees and other devotees? Well, the other devotees remind you of Krishna, and you can fully express your love with the other devotees. One may feel great love for a little caterpillar, but how do you really express that? It's a little difficult to have a reciprocation or with the table. But with another devotee, we can have these different loving exchanges that are all Krishna-centered. Majgatam, majgatam pranam, bodayantas parasparam, katayantas tamam nityam, tusyanti cha ramanti cha. The devotees feel fully satisfied and happy exchanging their confidential talks about Krishna. So by the devotees being together, they increase their love for Krishna. And as they increase their love for Krishna, they increase their love for each other. The devotees act as the impetus. So therefore, there's a special love. Just like Krishna says, "I'm equal to everyone. I'm no one's special friend, no one's special enemy, but I'm especially inclined to my devotees." Why? Not the way we're specially inclined to our child or our mother or something because we feel they're going to fulfill our lacks. But because Krishna can really reveal his heart to the devotees and really connect to the devotees in a deep and special way. Rahasyam idam uttamam. Because you are my devotee as well as my friend, I can give you this very secret knowledge. I can give you this sweetest thing. So that we can experience with the devotees. Of course, Srila Prabhupada wanted us to have a society like that. He said we should have a society of love and trust. I don't know if we've accomplished that. But at least within segments of our society, I think that each of us can find that. We can find at least some members of our society where we really have this relationship of love and trust, where we can exchange gifts and food and confidences about Krishna. And we just feel, with some devotees at least, "Oh, when I'm with this devotee, my love for Krishna increases and increases and increases, and therefore my love for this devotee also increases." So this is the kind of relationship that Bhishma is having with the Pandavas. Although Prabhupada's saying here that he was most satisfied that Duryodhana had won, and we talked about this yesterday, the irony of that, how Bhishma, who was trying to kill them and prevent them from winning, was very happy that they had won. And the great love that the Pandavas have for Bhishma, although they were the ones responsible for the arrows on which he was lying. But it's not just that that's happening here. That's certainly happening. It's not that that isn't happening. It's not that that isn't part of the story. But Krishna's right there. And so this exchange of affection between the Pandavas and Bhishma is fueling this affection for Krishna. So that is the way that we should deal with each other. It's not so easy. Sometimes it's extremely difficult. Sometimes we get caught up, or maybe many times we get caught up in the externals of our life, the different dramas of our family or our devotee family, because not only do we have dramas in our biological family, we definitely have dramas in our ISKCON family, which can be perhaps worse than the dramas in our biological family. And we may get caught up in the externals of these things and caught up in all the emotions of these sort of things. So that's understandable. Certainly it's understandable. But ultimately, we should come to these spiritual emotions. Ultimately, if we're caught up in the emotions of the external dramas, then it simply leads us to take birth again and again. I was just hearing Srila Prabhupada speak about this yesterday, that we really have to be careful that we're not investing our emotions in the relationships on a temporary basis. And it was on that basis that Kunti said, please cut that tie. Cut the tie of illusion. That I may have a relationship with a devotee that is devotional, but I may also have a relationship with them on the platform of illusion. But let me not have that kind of a relationship. Let me have just the relationship, as Prabhupada explains in his lecture, which is in Teachings of Queen Kunti, when Kunti asked this prayer. He said, seeing in the darkness is not seeing, but seeing in the light is seeing. And that we should have love soul to soul via the super soul. And then whether we have some other external relationship becomes irrelevant. So, I wanted to end early today because I know that some of you are going to the Bhakti Center, and probably that's why there's hardly any people here today. Probably a lot of people have already gone. So, any questions or comments or additions or subtractions? Yes?
So, in the verse about King Ambarish and how he engaged all his senses in serving the Lord, it says that he engaged his sense of touch in embracing the devotees.
Yes.
But we don't ever hear about any of the other devotees. So
who he was embracing?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like what if one is, you know, I mean, one may be in a place where there's, you know,
there's no devotees to embrace?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because we were just again teaching Manashiksha last night. And in text 7, where Raghunath Das Goswami says we get free from the desire to be honored for our devotion by serving the generals in Krishna's army. And Bhaktivinoda gives how do we do that service. One of them was embraces. So there was embracing the devotees, taking their foot dust, taking the water that's washed their feet, taking their food remnants. So we definitely have a culture of embracing in ISKCON. Yes? A number of devotees told me that they never really went around hugging people until they joined ISKCON. Definitely one of the way we greet other devotees, which should be of the same gender, though. But if you don't have, I suppose you could mentally, you could send a mental embrace to some devotee that you love if you don't have anyone in your physical proximity. That counts. You know, mental service always counts. Now, that doesn't mean you should just sit around sleeping and doing mental service. Years ago, we had a magazine, devotee magazine. This is pre-internet days, a printed magazine. And part of the magazine was what we call personal ads, people advertising for a husband or wife. Mm-hmm. And they would, you know, describe themselves and who they were looking for. And one of them, I'm not making this up, one of them who was looking for a wife, he said, my favorite service is to sleep and dream about Krishna. So I wasn't sure if he got any takers on that one. But in other words, not that we should just be lazy. It's not that we should just be lazy. Well, I'm going to meditate on embracing the devotees and I'm going to meditate on cooking. But if we can't do things externally, then we can certainly do them mentally. There's that story of the Brahmana in Nectar Devotion. Prabhupada also refers to it in the Bhagavatam, who was too poor to offer opulent service to the Lord. So he meditated on physically going to the sacred rivers, not just saying the mantra, Gange Jayajamanata, Bhagavatam, Rishwaswati, but he'd actually go to the rivers, collect the water in golden pots, and mentally he was bathing the deity. Prabhupada actually says we can do this while chanting japa. He says that in a lecture in Geneva. He actually says chanting Hare Krishna means, it's an interesting lecture, chanting Hare Krishna means that you make a diamond throne in your heart and you see Krishna there, and you bathe him with Ganga and Jamuna water, and you dress him, and you ornament him. And he said, so if you chant Hare Krishna like this, then every place you go becomes a pilgrimage. So I'm sure we can do service for the devotees mentally also. Should I tell you a really interesting story about mental service?
No.
It's a very famous story. It's in the book you gave me as a gift about what is real or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
What was that book called?
More Than Real.
I never did finish that book. Anyway, so he starts out with telling this story. It's very, very famous in South India, of a man like this Brahmana who heard that he could do mental service. So he was a worshipper of Lord Shiva. So he was also very poor, and he created a huge temple for Lord Shiva. It took him years. Every day he would meditate on how he was building this temple and engaging people. You know, every brick, every carving, every piece of marble, gold, like that. Meanwhile, in a nearby town, there was a king who was also a devotee of Lord Shiva, and he was building a physical temple for Lord Shiva. So as the time came to install the deity, he had a dream where Lord Shiva came to him and said, "You cannot install me on the date that you've planned, because on that date, I'm going to be installed in the temple of this other devotee in this other city. So you're going to have to wait to install me until after that ceremony is finished." And the king was like, "Wow, there's somebody in another temple building another city building a temple for Lord Shiva. I need to meet him." So he got his whole retinue and he travels to that city, and nobody knows about any temple being built. What are you talking about? And he has the name of this person. He finds it was this person who was building a temple in his mind. And on the day that the king wanted to install Lord Shiva appeared within the mind and heart of this other devotee and came into the temple he built with his mind. It's a very, very famous story known all over South India. So Krishna does accept the service. And of course we have the story in Chaitanya Charitamrita. What's his name? Singhananda Brahmacharya, who was building the road for Mahaprabhu. What was his name?
He couldn't keep going.
Something. And he had to stop at Kanai Natashala. He said, "I can't build the road past Kanai Natashala." He didn't understand why. But then when Mahaprabhu was actually traveling, he stopped at that place. He didn't go any further. So he was doing that in his mind. But if you can serve devotees personally, please do it. Yes, Prabhu.
What you're mentioning about the word prema. Kama prema janakara vibhinna lakshan vilaura ara hema yidhicha svarup vilakshan. And then the next, well, that one that talks about lust, the difference between love and lust, iron and gold. And then the next one is atmendya priti vanchata are balikam krishnendriya priti itscha dhare prema na. The desire to gratify one's own senses is kama, lust. But the desire to please the senses of Lord Krishna is prema, love.
Thank you. That leads into the idea that serving and loving the devotees in order to please Krishna is part of prema. Like Prabhupada says, "Love me, love my dog." You know, and in fact, Krishna is not pleased. It's very ironic. Krishna is not pleased if we say, "Okay, I'm only going to love you and I'm not going to love your devotees." In fact, that's the definition of a kanista. I only have love for God. I don't know how to treat anybody else. Or you're worshiping God in a different way. Let me kill you. You know, so Krishna is not pleased with that kind of love that doesn't include his devotees. And in fact, Krishna says he's more pleased when you love his devotees. But we're loving his devotees to please him, not to please ourselves. Yes?
Excuse me. I remember an experience that relates to this, and there's a question in it. And this was many years ago. My wife and I were visiting New Govardhan. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj was there. And he was addressing the devotees, who were mostly grihastas. And he was talking about how they should love each other. that as grihasthas they should cultivate love and affection for each other. And I was remarking, you know, this is Tamal Krishnamurti talking like this. He was, of course, very loving in many ways, but he would exemplify what you're speaking about, you know, that he loves Krishna and his love for, he would express, everything was related,
yes,
to service or something like that. And so you know, his boys, his team, and with others who were not, you know, so well connected with him in service, he would have a different kind of rasa, usually. But it brings to the question about, you mentioned, you know, Srila Prabhupada speaking about, will her love for her children help her to love Krishna? And Prabhupada saying, no, but her love for Krishna will help her love her children. But I question that when we don't have so much love for Krishna, sometimes, at least in our society, we've found that in the name of being devotees and wanting to love Krishna and serve Krishna, we put our families and children and those relationships in sort of a secondary position, and we consider any sort of affection or love that we might feel to be material and to be maya. And so the question comes that if there is a natural love and affection, it's not, you know, I would argue that it's not only in relationship to how that other person is going to serve my senses. Is there not something that, you know, it might even be a reflection of love of Krishna, but it's like we hear about the love of mother for their child as being close to, whatever.
So, I was really hoping somebody would ask this question. I was thinking, if I don't bring it up, will somebody ask this? What about people who are not fully in love with Krishna? How should they deal with others? And is there such a thing as real love for somebody who's not fully in love with Krishna? So let's answer the second one first. Is there something that we could call real love for someone who doesn't have love for Krishna?
There's certainly
some reflection of it. So we can understand something about real love by looking at some of the relationships in this world. Just like the definition given that love is when I want the happiness of someone else. In fact, Prabhupada defines the difference between material and spiritual. He said, spiritual means you're happy at someone else's happiness, and material means you're unhappy at someone else's happiness. So we do sometimes see in this world that people are genuinely happy at someone else's happiness. We do see that. And Prabhupada particularly talks about the mother and child. Of course, the mother and child have a very intimate bodily relationship, because the child grows inside the mother's body and is fed by the mother's body. And so the mother almost feels like the child is part of her body in a very deep way. I mean, the father feels like that, but I think for the mother it's very intense. And so people are just horrified when mothers hurt their children, much more so than any other, you know, it just, she must be mentally ill, is kind of the societal reaction. So we see it particularly between parents and children, and especially between mothers and children. But we also see it between lovers and husbands and wives and brothers and sisters and friends, where people will genuinely sacrifice their happiness for the happiness of another, and they feel happiness at the happiness of the other. But of course, it's not completely pure. There's something about it that's not quite there. And this is described very nicely in the 32nd chapter of the 10th canto. There's a class I give on this, where Krishna delineates nine kinds of relationships. And the best relationship is where you want the happiness of the other. The best example of that is the pure devotee, and the second best example of that is the family, particularly parents. So Krishna does give the family relationship, and especially the parental relationship, as a mundane example of that. Does it have value? Materially, it has a lot of value, because if you don't do that, then everybody's just in the mode of ignorance. But I mean, even animals often display this type of affection. And Prabhupada talks about this, of course, in the preface to the Nectar of Devotion about tigers. But there's these mice called scorpion mice. You know, we think of mice as eating grains, but there are mice that eat scorpions. They fight with scorpions. Look it up. They fight with scorpions and they kill them. And they're heavy-duty mice. I mean, you just think about what kind of mouse it is that's going to fight with and kill scorpions. So they're you know, like we're talking about Bhishma's crying over the Pandavas, although he's a real warrior. But these mice cry over their children. If some owl takes one of their children, I ran a Gurukul for years, so I watched a lot of nature videos and science videos. So anyway, that's why I know about this stuff. So they were showing these videos how the owl takes away one of the baby mice. And the mother and father mice are embracing each other and crying that some owl has taken our baby. So this kind of affection is seen even within, you know, animals, even within not very developed animals. And without that, you can't have the material world can't even function. You know, if there's not that kind of affection between family and between friends, then what would we be? I mean, it definitely has some value as far as just the peace and stability of society, without which bhakti is very difficult. Like Prabhupada said, it's hard to preach to someone who's hungry because all they'll be thinking about is what they want to eat. Or, you know, I've tried giving class in a room that's way too hot or way too cold or where there's not enough air. Or where, you know, the program has gone on so long that everybody's hungry and nobody can pay any attention to the shastra. Everyone's just like, oh, or when's prasadam? So I see it the same way emotionally. You know, if people don't have, and Prabhupada talks about this. He says, you know, people need to get their eating, sleeping, mating, and defending taken care of, or they can't be peaceful for bhakti. So I see it has a great value in that respect. And Prabhupada says the purpose of marriage is to make the mind peaceful so you can execute bhakti. How is it going to be peaceful if everybody's nasty to each other? That's not peaceful. I don't really love you, you're just Maya. You know, I mean, sorry, been there, seen that, done that. And it's not conducive at all. It also has some value in that we can learn something. Like Robin says, you should chant like a child crying for his mother. If you've never had an affectionate relationship with your mother, how are you going to chant like a child crying for his mother? You know, well, my mother abused me, or whatever, you know. How are you going to relate to that? And we see that people who have terrible family situations, they have a hard time having any love and trust for anybody, or having any love or trust for God. So I see it has some value just in trying to get a little bit of understanding about God. Does it have any transcendent value in and of itself? I'm afraid we'd have to say no. You know, that in and of itself, anything in the modes, even in the mode of goodness, where Krishna says happiness in the mode of goodness can awaken one to self-realization. But if it doesn't awaken you to self-realization, then one simply gets conditioned by a sense of happiness. And so we see even people in the mode of goodness, I'm so forgiving, and I'm so loving, and I see the oneness of everybody. So why don't you chant Hare Krishna? I don't need to chant Hare Krishna. One devotee was telling me this just the day before, or the day of Rath Yatra, maybe. He was saying how his daughter is so much in the mode of goodness that she doesn't see a need for Krishna consciousness. Well, I'm already happy. So in and of itself, even the most loving and the most selfless relationships, they're not bhakti. So that's my first answer, is do they have value? Yes and no. Then what about if we're not fully Krishna conscious? How should we behave with everyone? Well, my answer to that is behave with everyone to try to please Krishna. As part of my falling in love with Krishna, I want to deal with, why just other living beings? I want to deal with the table and my shoes and the chair and this napkin to please Krishna. So how does Krishna want me to treat my husband or my wife or my children? How does he want? Does he want me to? I mean, is that what he wants? Krishna's saying, I'm putting you in association with this other jiva. How should we treat them? You know, if somebody, and many, many people have given me their children to watch, they're not my children. How do they want me to treat their children? Right? Isn't it? You're watching somebody else's child? So all other jivas that we're taking care of, they're Krishna's. They belong to Krishna. They're so dear to Krishna. How should I deal with them? Even if I'm just a very, very beginning devotee and I don't really have any love for Krishna at all, if I want to develop my love for Krishna, don't I have to deal kindly with all living entities? If Krishna's in my heart and Krishna's in their heart and he's watching and he's listening, what am I going to say? Krishna, you put, and not only, what to speak of, you know, your husband, your wife, your child, your grandchild, your brother, your sister, your mother, your father, even some stranger on the street, even someone we deal with for a moment on the subway train, everybody, let me deal with them in a way that Krishna will smile. And therefore, throughout the Shastra, a kind friend to all living entities, kind friend to all living entities, kind friend to all living entities. It's everywhere. If we're not a kind friend to all living entities, attaining bhakti is impossible. So it's part of our sadhana. If we don't do that, we'll never progress beyond the lowest level of kanista. And using Krishna consciousness as an excuse to be cruel or heartless with other living entities is just the lowest, lowest, lowest level of kanista. Lord Kapila Dev says it's like trying to make an offering into ashes. There's no effect. I mean, Jesus said, if you have an offering to make on the altar and you have a quarrel with your brother, put down your offering, fix your quarrel, and then come back and make your offering. So it's absolutely essential part of sadhana. What to speak of? Somebody who's in an intimate relationship with us. That means Krishna's given us some special service for this jiva. Someone I see on the subway for 2 seconds, I want to be kind to them because Krishna's watching. What to speak of somebody that's my child that I'm going to have a relationship with my whole life? So, you know, what does Krishna and Balaram say to Vasudeva and Devaki? You know, those who have a chaste wife but they don't take care of her, or those who have elderly parents who need help and they don't, I forget exactly the words, but he condemns such people. So I see it's part of sadhana. It's also part of sadhana to develop detachment. So it's part of our sadhana to treat everybody with love and affection, especially those people for whom we have special responsibility. And it's also our sadhana not to deal with people in a way where we're using them to meet our needs. Both of them, simultaneously. They're both. Detachment is also repeated everywhere. Both things. Be a kind friend to all living entities and be detached from friends, enemies, neutral. Both are running simultaneously. And if you just take one without the other, then you're going to be a little off balance and fall over on your face. Yes, and then I think after this we'll stop.
So you're saying that the word prema obviously has different levels of different meanings.
Yes. Well, here prema is being used between the Pandavas and Bhishma. Yeah.
It made me think when you were talking about the table. Sometimes, many times we see that, like in the cushions in the temple room, for example, someone has to pick it up. Rather than pick it up,
they kick it.
They'll kick it.
Yes. Everything.
It's caught.
Everything. I mean, I'm working on a book with Hari Vilas's sister, Kamala Sita. She and I are writing a book, we're almost done with it, on meditations on Krishna in the world. So from Bhagavad Gita and from Bhagavatam, from the universal form descriptions, from Bhagavad Gita universal form descriptions, Bhagavad Gita also in chapter 7, 9, and 15, and 10, how Krishna is manifested in the world. And, you know, that this world is the body of God. So he's conscious of it. I mean, it's his material body, so to speak. But just like I'm conscious of my body, so he's conscious of his body. So the table isn't conscious of itself. It's not a jiva. But Krishna's conscious of it. Krishna's not conscious of it like I'm conscious of the table that I can see it. Krishna can feel, when I touch the table, Krishna can feel that. It's part of his body. Part of his form. He's the super soul who's animating this body of the universe. So everything, this is our chintabheda beta tattva. That all objects with which we interact are all part of the body of the Lord. And of course, the paraphernalia used in service is directly Balaram. So, there you go. Now imagine if we had this consciousness. That Krishna is... For one who sees me everywhere, who sees everything in me, I'm never lost to him, nor is he ever lost to me. And I haven't counted, but there's so many times when Prabhupada will say, especially in his lectures, you want to see God, see him in the sunlight, see him in the moonlight, see him in the taste of water. The light in all luminous objects, the sound in ether, our ability, everything. Hearing sounds from the other room. Prabhupada said, the sound and ether, they're all reflections of the sounds of the spiritual world. It's a reflection of Krishna talking with his devotees in the spiritual world. I did say that was the last one. It's 5 to 9, and I know that a lot of you need to get into Manhattan. So, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.